Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Tracy McClure. Coming up over the next half hour, raising awareness about the need to defend the environment, how some Catholic religious communities are putting the Church's teachings on ecology into practice. And a look at St. Thomas More, the 16th century English lawyer, writer, and statesman who died for his devotion to church teachings and for his loyalty to the Pope in Rome. Not just words, but actions, putting into practice what the Church preaches about the environment. It's a challenge that Pope Benedict shows he is determined to meet. You can see that in the solar panels he had installed on the roof of the Vatican's audience hall and the funding of tree planting in Hungary. In his many discourses, encyclicals, and his 2010 World Day of Peace message, he's placed ecology and protecting the environment as top priorities for all of us. For Pope Benedict, the ecological crisis our planet is now facing comes as part of a wider moral crisis. From what he calls a self-centered and materialistic way of thinking, which fails to acknowledge the limitations inherent in every creature. He's telling us it's time to get our priorities straight. Well, I've heard of at least one group of American nuns go almost totally eco-friendly, revamping their convent with the latest energy and water-saving technology so their environmental footprint reaches near zero. Brothers bicycling instead of taking the car, cutting back on laundry loads and making sure the lights are off when they leave a room. And still others committing to fair trade products to make their food and gift purchases count towards helping the poor and cutting back carbon emissions. Well, not everyone knows how they can put into practice what the Church and the Pope preaches about the environment. There are lots of small ways, from choosing the products you buy at the supermarket to the way you get to work or school. In part of an increasing trend raising awareness among religious congregations, the Brothers of Charity have asked experts from the Catholic peace movement Pax Christi to give them advice and guidance about how to be more conscientious about the environment. I sat down with Pax Christi's Jeff Felix from the International Office in Brussels and Prakash Gosens from the Brothers of Charity, who told me more about why his congregation wanted to form this new partnership.
As a congregation, Catholic congregation, we are based in Rome. Although our operational quarters are in Ghent, Belgium, and we work in the field of mental health, special education, and care for disabled persons. But we want to work also on the issues of climate change, because it's very important also, because it affects our apostolate.
In what way?
In different ways. For example, we have a project in northern India, Ranchi, where because of lack of water, we have to see how we can deal with this issue so that we can continue our apostolate of or to taking care of psychiatric patients.
Psychiatric patients.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So and other example is in...
Probe there for a second. What exactly, how is it exactly affecting your apostolate work with psychiatric patients?
Well, in the
lack of water?
Yeah, the lack of water, meaning drinkable water, mm-hmm. fresh water. Mm-hmm. North of India is actually distributed water from the Himalayas. And the big rivers coming from the Himalayas towards the city where we are based in Ranchi is drying out. And it's already drying out now. So that means that we are lacking of drinkable water. So we have to find other sources to get water for our patients, but also for our brothers, for our apostolate work. And in that way, we thought it might be interesting to get some experts in the fields of environment. And that's the reason why we got in contact with Pax Christi International, which is a peace movement also working on environment.
Okay. And you, Jeff?
Well, the first opportunity, of course, was at the invitation of the Brothers of Charity to spend the day with them.
Were you surprised by a religious order asking you to come over to give them some expertise?
Not really, because as I look back at the last 5 years, there is a growing interest, especially among religious congregations, and even more from the sister side and from the brother side, in the issue of integrity of creation. That's a very positive development, because congregations in the history were many times in the forefront to, in a prophetic way, take position and act, being like the pioneers. And it's the case for these new signs of the time they read this issue on integrity of creation. That was so the first opportunity to be here.
That's an interesting expression, integrity of creation. What exactly do you mean by that?
Well, by integrity of creation, we mean what the Pope expressed in his recent message for the World Day of Peace of this year, under the title, If You Want to Cultivate Peace, Protect Creation. And there he is exposing a very deep vision of the indivisible unity between God, human beings, and the whole of creation. We cannot separate anymore creation from all living beings, not just the humans, but also all the species, and God, the Creator. And integrity of creation is that we should look at creation as God has designed it, his dream of a creation where there is harmony, peace, care of not only stewardship, like an administrator, but like a gardener who is taking care of the plants, like a father is caring his children. So God is caring the earth, and we, created as his image and likeness, we have to do the same. And that's the expression of integrity of creation.
Now, you, in your story about India and your psychiatric clinic, you have a very practical problem facing you now. How is what Jeff is saying, how have you, do you think you're able to turn that into something positive that's going to help you fix the problem that you have right now?
Well, on different levels. First of all, for our brothers themselves to get awareness, to be aware of the environmental issues.
Well, it soon became clear at a recent meeting of regional leaders of the Brothers of Charity that they were not aware of the extent to which environmental factors are influencing local ministries.
They were surprised to hear in one way the facts of the crisis that our earth is facing. That's what, first thing is awareness. Second is contemplation, because we are also a religious congregation. We have to contemplate also in our prayers, in our all being, what does it mean, integrity of creation? And we will put it also in an action plan for the formation of the young brothers. Secondly, for our co-workers, because we are working with lay people, psychiatrists, psychologists, social workers, we have to inform them and also their families, because we are living also in with them together. And thirdly, to see in our constructions of buildings for the project that we take into account the ecological access facilities, so that you can make continue your apostolate, but in an environmental adapted way.
So, are you talking solar panels or
Not specifically. Sometimes, yes. For example, in the south of India, we have another project where we are working with solar panels, but it can be all kind of renewable energy possibilities. Another thing is to be also aware of the ecological footprint that we have as a human being, the space that a human being takes in the environment, and what does it mean if we spend so much energy on this and so on. So we will work on that in a progressive plan, and we hope to do that together with the advice of Pax Christi International. Mm.
I see you nodding your head there, Jeff, when he was mentioning the global footprint. What do you want to add to that?
Well, You know, in the field of becoming aware of what is the environmental crisis, the warming of the climate, climate change, and so on, one instrument for awareness building where people, at the individual, within a household, but also communities in a congregation, just to measure what is their impact, yes, on climate change, measuring the ecological footprint is a very nice instrument. For instance, taking your expenses on electricity on a year basis, use of gas, whether you use public transport or a car, the size of your car, yes? If you use vegetables, seasonable vegetables, or whether you have to import them from Africa in the middle of winter, that's a high ecological footprint in terms of carbon emissions, yes, carbon fossil fuel needed to transport, yes?
Sure, but at the same time, you're helping the people in Africa make money because there's a market for their products.
That is right, but there are many other means to help these people. And we have to look in concrete terms, what is really their profit? Of course, if you are in the field of fair trade, then you are sure. But fair trade is not exporting vegetables or fruit or meat to Europe, for instance, with a high ecological footprint, because the clients, the consumers of these Magasin du Monde, the world shops, will not buy them because of the ecological footprint. You see?
One thing that I always notice when I go to the supermarket and I think of my ecological footprint is these styrofoam containers that they put the fruit and vegetables in, you know, and the boxes and of the cereal. And if you go to a toy store, if you have children and you have these enormous boxes and big plastic containers when there's a tiny little toy inside, what does that say also about our consumption of all of these things and our ecological footprint?
Well, that's part of a cycle we go through, because our way of producing and consuming is not only consuming fuel and energy with the CO2 emission, but is also creating a lot of waste. And waste, you can do different things. You can recycle it. But then it should be of the nature to be recycled, and more waste can be recycled, yes?
More and more what, sorry?
Waste. Mm-hmm. But, for instance, plastic. Mm-hmm. Many plastics cannot be recycled, and the one you mentioned are part of, you have to drop them. You have to throw them away. And then it ends up where? Sometimes it ends up in the sea. And you know that between New Zealand and Australia, there, due to the undersea currents in the oceans, there is an enormous mountain of plastic who is turning there around, of plastic that cannot be decomposed, yet, that cannot be recycled. And it will be there for centuries and centuries before it will disappear one way or another. That's also an invisible, hidden effect of our mode of production and consumption.
These are all very interesting things, food for thought, I'd say. But experts are generally agreeing today that if temperatures rise, we're going to have seas rising. We're going to have desertification in Africa, the Middle East. We're going to see islands disappearing and Bangladesh losing land. I mean, we're going to be seeing conflicts over water. What should we be thinking now?
What we should think of is to have solutions to the warming up of the environment, solutions at a structural level. That means that at the level of the politicians controlling the business world and the trade companies to bring down the emissions of CO2 so that we do not pass through a ceiling of plus 2 degrees centigrade. If we go beyond, then we will reach a tipping point of no return. And it is a disaster that the Copenhagen conference in December of last year didn't reach any concrete solution because of a power struggle between mainly the United States and China and the others just watching, not being part of the game. There will be a follow-up conference in December of 2011 in Mexico. Most probably there will be little change, but our hope is that in 2011, and with a major role of the European Union and the so-called new industry alliance countries, when they join hands, then we can have a protocol where the reducing the emissions of CO2 will be at least 40% by 2050. If not, then it will be a disaster for humanity.
If I may add, what is also important as a Catholic congregation, Brother of Charity, is that when we talk about the poorest of the poor and taking care of the poorest of the poor, that means in the future, and it's already happening, we will get more and more, because of these ecological conflicts for water, but also for other reasons, that you had ecological refugees. And as a congregation, we will take also forefront in this issue to take care of this new poverty issues, because ecology will become also for human beings a new poverty issue.
And thanks there to Prakash Gosens from the Brothers of Charity and to Jeff Felix from the Catholic Peace Movement Pax Christi International. He's one of the Church's most erudite saints who died for his devotion to the Church's teachings and for his loyalty to the Pope in Rome. 16th century Englishman Sir Thomas More was a lawyer, intellectual, author, and statesman, beatified in the 19th century and finally canonized in the 20th. Jill Bevilacqua tells us more about him.
The man who has been called England's greatest Catholic martyr, and whose feast day is celebrated by both Catholics and Anglicans, Thomas More, born in 1478 and put to death in 1535, was a highly successful lawyer, and consequently a man who knew how to use words. Cardinal Wolsey, whom More later succeeded as Lord Chancellor of England, recommended him to be Speaker of the House of Commons. Of his writings, it was More's Utopia, a description in Latin of an ideal state, published in 1516, which was to become the best known. It was also the first work of the Renaissance in England to become known all over Catholic Europe. And its title contributed a new word to the language. A lesser-known work, but for some the finest thing More ever wrote, was his History of King Richard III, unfinished and not published in his lifetime. The familiar story of the murder of the little princes in the Tower is followed by a vivid picture of the state of mind of the usurper king, who, as we know, also came to a bad end on Bosworth Field.
I have heard by credible report of such as were secret with his chamberers that after this abominable deed done, he never had quiet in his mind, he never thought himself sure. Where he went abroad, his eyes whirled about, his body privily fenced, his hand ever on his dagger, his countenance and manner like one, always ready to strike again. He took ill rest o' nights, lay long waking and musing, sore wearied with care and watch, rather slumbered than slept, troubled with fearful dreams. Suddenly sometimes start up, leap out of his bed and run about the chamber. So was his restless heart continually tossed and tumbled with the tedious impression and stormy remembrance of his abominable deed.
In A Meditation on Death, The Four Last Things, never published, More comments wryly on those who are busier on their deathbed with thoughts of a stylish funeral than the state of their souls.
So many torches, so many tapers, so many black gowns, so many merry mourners laughing under black hoods, and a gay hearse with the delight of goodly and honourable funerals, in which the foolish sick man is sometimes occupied as though he thought that he should stand in a window and see how worshipfully he shall be brought to church.
Thomas More was a very witty man, and even when writing of serious things, his humour frequently surfaces. When describing the last moments of a dying man, he reminds us what it's like when you're feeling very sick to have people ask questions and want answers.
Will it not be, as I was about to say, a pleasant thing to see before thine eyes and hear at thine ear a rabble of fleshly friends, or rather of fleshly flies, skipping about thy bed and thy sick body like ravens about thy corpse, now almost carrion, crying to thee on every side, "What shall I have? What shall I have?" Then shall come thy children and cry for their parts. Then shall come thy sweet wife, and wherein thine health haply she spake thee not one sweet word in 6 weeks, now shall she call thee sweet husband, and weep with much work, and ask thee what shall she have. Then shall thine executors ask for the keys, and ask what money is owing thee. Ask what substance thou hast, and ask where thy money lieth. And while thou liest in that case, their words shall be so tedious that thou wilt wish all that they ask for upon a red fire, so thou mightest lie 1/2 hour in rest.
But More did treat of serious things very seriously. When Martin Luther attacked Henry VIII in a vitriolic tract, someone had to answer for the king. More wrote his response to Luther in Latin, unsigned and using very strong language. Then in 1529 came his great Dialogue Concerning Heresies, written in English, a defence of the old faith on the eve of England's break with Rome. Thomas More was committed to the Tower of London in the April of 1534, after refusing to swear to the Act of Succession, which declared Henry's first marriage null, his second valid, and marriage subject to secular law. In the time left him, before he was beheaded in July 1535, More composed a number of spiritual works, among which his Dialogue of Comfort Against Tribulation shines out brightly.
Let one choose himself some secret solitary place in his own house, as far from noise and company as he conveniently can, and hither let him sometime secretly resort alone. There let him open his heart to God.
More was a man writing in prison, and a powerful part of this work presents God as a jailer and life on earth as the prison he has placed us in.
So sure and so subtly builded, that albeit that it lieth open on every side, without any wall in the world, yet wander we never so far about therein. The way to get out shall we never find. Upon our prison we build our prison. We garnish it with gold and make it glorious. In this prison they buy and sell. In this prison they brawl and chide. In this they run together and fight. In this they dice. In this they card. In this they pipe and revel. In this they sing and dance. In this prison many a man reputed right honest ceases not for his pleasure in the dark privately to play the knave.
But even in this circumstance, More finds room for jest. In this next extract, he's having a quiet dig at Dame Alice, his second wife. He is talking of a woman who berates her husband because he has no ambition.
What would you do that you care not to put forth yourself as other folk do? Will you sit still by the fire and make goslings in the ashes with a stick as children do? Would God I were a man, and look what I would do. Why, wife, her husband said, what would you do? What? By God, go forward with the best, for as my mother used to say, God have mercy on her soul, it is ever more better to rule than be ruled, and therefore, by God, I would not, I warrant you, be so foolish to be ruled where I might rule. By my truth, wife, said her husband, in this I dare say you say truth, for I never found you willing to be ruled yet.
Before his imprisonment, More had begun a work known as The Treatise on the Passion. He continued this meditation in his last great work, De Tristitia Christi, On the Sadness of Christ, where the scene is the agony in the garden. Written in Latin, it was translated by his granddaughter into English. But the original manuscript in More's handwriting was only discovered in 1963 in Valencia, Spain. Here, More puts these words on the lips of Christ.
What, though thou be fearful, sorry, and weary, and standest in great dread of most painful torments, be of good comfort, for I myself have vanquished the whole world, and yet felt I far more fear, sorrow, weariness, and much more inward anguish too, when I considered my most bitter, painful passion to press so fast upon me. But thou now, O timorous and weak, silly sheep, think it sufficient for thee only to walk after me, which am thy shepherd and governor, and so mistrust thyself and put thy trust in me. Take hold on the hem of my garment, therefore. From thence thou shalt receive such strength and relief to proceed.
And so More did proceed, and in his last days wrote this prayer in the margins of a Latin book of hours, which can be seen today in the rare book library of Yale University.
Give me thy grace, good Lord, to set the world at naught, to set my mind fast upon thee, and not to hang upon the blast of men's mouths, to be content to be solitary, not to long for worldly company. Little and little utterly to cast off the world, and rid my mind of all the business thereof. Not to long to hear of any worldly things, but that the hearing of worldly fantasies may be to me displeasant. Gladly to be thinking of God, piteously to call for his help. To lean upon the comfort of God, busily to labor to love him. To know my own vileness and wretchedness, to humble and meeken myself under the mighty hand of God, to bewail my sins past, for the purging of them patiently to suffer adversity, gladly to bear my purgatory here, to be joyful of tribulations, to walk the narrow way that leadeth to life, to bear the cross with Christ, to have the last thing in remembrance, to have ever afore mine eye my death that is ever at hand.
And thanks there to Jill Bevilacqua for that program from her series on Catholic writers, The Pen is Mightier Than the Sword. Well, on October 31st in the year 2000, Pope John Paul II declared Thomas More patron saint of statesmen and politicians, remarking on what he called the witness which he bore, even at the price of his life, to the primacy of truth over power. The Holy Father noted that More's life and martyrdom were rooted in holiness, saying his profound detachment from honors and wealth, his serene and joyful humility, his balanced knowledge of human nature and of the vanity of success, his certainty of judgment rooted in faith, these all gave him that confident inner strength that sustained him in adversity and in the face of death. His sanctity shone forth in his martyrdom, but it had been prepared by an entire life of work devoted to God and neighbor. I'm Tracy McClure. Thanks for listening. Laudator Jesus Christus.